From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up on today's program, student clashes with authorities in Myanmar have drawn concerns from the international community and U.S. lawmakers. We have details in just a moment on Daybreak Asia. How old is retirement age in China? Sarah Williams tries to find out on China Focus. Illicit alcohol consumption in Sri Lanka actually serves several social purposes. That, according to an author. There's trash in the Pacific Ocean. Lots of it. Ira Melman sits down in the American Cafe to sort through the debris. Can a professional singer sing in space? We'll hit all the soaring notes with David Byrd on today's Now. Your favorite music artist may be young and hip, but is also probably singing some very old standards. We'll have business and sports as well, all coming up on today's VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia. Hi, and welcome to our summary of Asia news and events for Thursday, March 12th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, in Japan, thousands of people are still homeless, and all of the nation's nuclear reactors are still offline 4 years after a magnitude 9.0 earthquake and tsunami caused the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl. VOA's Brian Patton reports that Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has promised a 5-year reconstruction plan for the areas still devastated by the disaster. But he remains a nuclear energy advocate despite strong public opposition.
More than 120,000 residents who live within 20 kilometers of Japan's Daiichi nuclear power plant in Fukushima were evacuated in March of 2011 after the damaged nuclear plant started leaking radiation. These nuclear refugees still cannot return home because of high radiation levels, and they still worry about suffering from long-term health implications like cancer due to the radiation exposure. Professor Jeff Kingston, the director of Asian Studies at Temple University Japan, says they have come to symbolize the danger of nuclear power.
These people all understand very well about the myth of safety that the government and the utilities had propagated over preceding decades.
Prime Minister Shinzo Abe vowed this week to come up with a new 5-year plan to rebuild the Pacific coastal region that was ravaged by the tsunami. The government has reportedly already spent $50 billion in the hardest hit areas. Japan has allocated more than $15 billion for a project to lower radiation in towns near the plant where radioactive trash is being kept in 88,000 temporary storage facilities. Tokyo also plans to build a more permanent nuclear storage facility near the plant, despite opposition from some residents. After the Fukushima disaster, all of Japan's 48 nuclear reactors were shut down. They remain closed because of safety concerns and because opinion polls indicate that more than 60% of the public now oppose nuclear energy. Yet Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who recently won re-election by a wide margin, remains a nuclear power supporter. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The state-operated Global New Light of Myanmar says a government-run inquiry will look into violent confrontations between student protesters and police, the most recent occurring Tuesday, which sparked global condemnation and raises concerns about the path to reform in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The students are opposed to a draft national education bill they say will stifle academic freedom. The violence prompted a global reaction, including demands for an investigation by the European Union, Britain, and the United States, where spokeswoman Jen Psaki commented Tuesday.
We urge the government of Burma to respect the right of protesters to assemble peacefully as a means of expressing their views. Freedom of assembly is an important component of any democratic society. We condemn the use of force taken against peaceful protesters. We are deeply concerned by reports of violence by police and other individuals against protesters and journalists in Le Pedon. We are deeply concerned by the reports of arrests and will continue to closely monitor the situation. To your second question, we are, of course, in regular contact with the government of Burma. We've repeatedly called on all parties to exercise restraint. At this point, we are speaking to all the relevant parties and our international partners to ascertain the specific cause of the clashes, and we're also working to confirm the number of individuals arrested and injured.
Two U.S. congressmen, Democrat Joe Crowley and Republican Steve Chabot, called on the government to end violent assaults on students, journalists, and monks. Sean Turnell is a Southeast Asia analyst in Australia, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the use of civilian deputies alongside police is a return to the old days when the country was run by a military junta.
These vigilante groups, some of which go under the name of Swin Shin, have been used before, and it's really disturbing to see them being used again. Even apart from those groups, I think the regular police seem to have broken all sorts of internal guidelines when it comes to breaking up peaceful demonstrations.
Myanmar state media announced today, Wednesday, an inquiry into the protest crackdown. Do you expect anything to come out of that?
I'm hopeful. In the past, of course, one couldn't have expected anything, but there are elements within the current Burmese government that would be very unhappy with this, and particular, of course, that it's gone around the world, and it tarnishes still further the reform efforts that some groups within the country are undertaking. So I'm hopeful that something will emerge from it, but I'd have to say the drift of policy in Myanmar or Burma the last few months has not been good, so my expectations are not high.
To what do you attribute this drift?
Well, I think it's partly the lead-up to the elections later this year, and I think a lot of the old conservative, recalcitrant elements are really beginning to mobilise themselves now, because I think they see that, you know, that the government remains deeply unpopular and that Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, would sweep the elections if they were genuinely free and fair later this year.
Turnell says he suspects the violence is a result of the country's forthcoming election, with some in the government seeing instability as an excuse to postpone the ballot. U.S. Ambassador to South Korea Mark Lippert is out of the hospital and recovering a week after he was slashed across the face and wrist by a knife-wielding assailant. Now authorities say the attacker might have also violated a decades-old anti-communism law. But some rights groups say the attack shows how the law mainly limits freedom of speech without improving public safety. Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
Kim Ki-jong was immediately arrested after attacking the American ambassador. Following a search of the 55-year-old home and office, South Korean police say they found pro-North Korean propaganda, which is illegal under the country's national security law. That law concerns Park Geun-young of the civic group People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy.
It is a shame that this attack carried out by one violent man is bringing attention to other activists who do not share the South Korean government's thoughts on North Korea and might use the national security law to go after them now.
The late 1940s law was created to stop the spread of communist North Korea's influence in the South. Today, rights advocates say it mainly limits freedom of speech and sends innocent people to jail. In 2012, Park Jung-geun was found guilty of violating the national security law and given a suspended sentence. As South Korean investigators look for North Korean links to the ambassador's assault, Pyongyang praised the attack but maintains it had nothing to do with it. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Stop by voanews.com for these and many more stories from the Asian region. And while you're there, subscribe to the free Daybreak Asia podcast. So what do you think of the stories you just heard on VOA Global? Well, many of you have commented on some of the stories that we've posted on our website at voanews.com, like this one. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott is coming under criticism after he lamented what he called the lifestyle choices of the country's remote indigenous community. Norman Brown responded to that story. He says, Australia, you're experiencing a small bit of what Americans have put up with. Having Republicans, parentheses conservatives, in charge is a nightmare, he says. They keep making comments that people find very offensive and then have their cronies back them up in their speech only to perpetuate hate. Can we assume Norman Brown is a Democrat? Maybe. Another story that we had on our website. U.S. and Pakistani officials are looking to boost bilateral trade and economic ties this week as U.S. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker visits Islamabad. Officials want to encourage U.S. investment as well as improve economic opportunities for Pakistani women. We had comments from both Pakistan and India. First, Abdul Basit, 1964, from Lahore, Pakistan. The so-called U.S.-Pakistan Economic Partnership talks fizzled out when the U.S. delegate refused to allow Pakistan special trade concessions. Pakistan's trade volume with the EU is much lower than it is with the USA. However, the EU allowed Pakistan the requested concessions, which have proven their worth to the country's economy. Raman from India writes, with Pakistan bending backwards to please China, how come it's not saying or dictating to China but to the U.S.? Let it be known that Pakistan was and is still a place where terror is encouraged with little or no oversight from the government. Well, two very diverging opinions. You can find many more on our website at voanews.com. You know, we have other sites, too, besides our website. You can follow us on Weibo and Twitter. And, yeah, I was online looking at Facebook just a little while ago. I really like our Facebook page, VOA Asia Facebook. If you haven't been there yet, come visit it. Like it yourself. We'd love to have you stop by and check out what's on it. And, you know, you'll never know what you'll find on there. It's updated all the time.
The apparent high level of illegal alcohol consumption in Sri Lanka has interesting social implications as it relates to religion, family structure, and economic distinctions. I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Michelle Ruth Gambard, who has spent much time studying local society in the small village of Nagama, about 80 kilometers south of the capital, Colombo. She is professor and chair of anthropology at Portland State University in the northwestern U.S. state of Oregon and presents her findings in the book, Breaking the Ashes.
I was walking down the road to get my newspaper one morning, and I heard one guy yell to another that he was going to break the ashes, and I didn't know what that meant, but I asked my research associate when I got home, and he gave me this odd look, and he said, "That's just a little bit of insider humor from one drinker to another." Breaking the ashes refers to what housewives do when they get up in the morning. They kind of get the hearth going again. They break up the ashes from last night's fire, and they get the wood in for this morning's fire so they can brew up a cup of tea. But the ashes and the fire that the drinker is talking about is the warmth that they get from a shot of liquor.
Buddhism, obviously, is the main religion there, and there are prohibitions against the consumption of mind-altering substances, but the young men in the area are drinking more and more.
In Buddhism, at least in Theravada Buddhism as it's practiced in Sri Lanka, there are five precepts that are roughly equivalent to something like the Ten Commandments, maybe, in Christianity. And the fifth precept is that people shouldn't take mind-altering substances. I think both men and women would consider themselves Buddhists, but when I ask why women don't drink, often Buddhism was raised as a reason, whereas when I ask why men do drink or don't drink, other issues are raised instead.
A large percentage of illicit liquor would certainly get the state's attention in the fact that they would want more revenue from taxes, and yet if it's that large, the local police obviously must be aware of it, but there must be an interesting dynamic going on there if the percentages remain so high.
That's a very good question. In fact, I had an entire chapter written about, you know, allegations of corruption and the complicity between the police and local politicians and local manufacturers of illicit liquor. And for a variety of reasons, including ethical ones of not wanting to get anybody in trouble, that chapter didn't make it into the final book.
There is ceremonial drinking that takes place, and that certainly is condoned socially. How often does this take place? What sort of ceremonies? Is this a daily thing, monthly thing, or once in a while for holidays?
I think that people there drink as we do here in terms of, you know, if you're having a feast, if you're having a party, if somebody's getting married, if there's a retirement or a promotion to celebrate, I would say that drinking at that sort of ceremony is kind of episodic. Many of those ceremonies take place at auspicious times, and those auspicious times tend to cluster. There are also yearly moments to celebrate. Just as we have holidays, they have holidays. Similarly, while there are times when people might drink more, there are also times when people might drink less. So, for example, around the Vaisak full moon holiday in May, this is a holiday celebrated to commemorate the birth, the enlightenment, and the death of the Lord Buddha. That's a time when people really rein in their drinking.
Michelle Ruth Gambert, professor and chair of anthropology at Portland State University and author of several books, including Breaking the Ashes, The Culture of Illicit Liquor in Sri Lanka. It is published by Cornell University Press. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll pull another volume from our bookshelves next week when you may hear more authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website, VOA Asia Facebook page, and SoundCloud.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The top Communist Party leader in China's remote and restive region of Xinjiang says he believes religious extremists have left the country to join Islamic State militants overseas and then return home. The comments highlight Beijing's continuing concern over religious extremism among the country's Muslim Uyghur ethnic group. But critics say the government's repressive policies in Xinjiang are partly to blame. VOA's Bill Ide has more.
Xinjiang Communist Party Secretary Zhang Chunxian did not say how many extremists from the region have fled overseas to join the fighting. But he says their participation highlights how global extremist movements are affecting Xinjiang. Speaking with reporters at a Xinjiang delegation meeting on the sidelines of parliamentary meetings in Beijing Tuesday, Zhang says some fighters who have fought for the Islamic State abroad have returned to China. Zhang says that recently authorities have cracked a case involving people who have just come back from fighting. He says authorities have said nothing about the case so far because they need time to solve the case, limit casualties, and maintain security. It is unclear just how many from Xinjiang or China have joined the Islamic State. Analysts say that the numbers are small. But according to a Chinese state media report late last year, around 300 militants from the region are in Syria and Iraq, participating in fighting and receiving training. Most are said to be members of the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, a group considered a terrorist organization by the United States. Beijing routinely blames ETIM militants for carrying out attacks in China. China says the group wants to establish a separate state in Xinjiang, but critics have raised questions about its organizational structure and real capabilities. Exiled Uyghur groups and human rights activists say it is the Chinese government's tough policies in Xinjiang that is the main driver of the unrest and violence there. Following violent ethnic clashes in 2009, China has tightened regulations on Muslim practices in the region, restricting veils and beards, and issuing rules that prohibit fasting during Ramadan. China is frequently accused of violating its guarantees for religious freedoms in Xinjiang. Officials at the meeting on Tuesday stressed that dealing with the threat of religious extremism is a challenge that many countries face. A spike in violence over the past 2 years has claimed the lives of several hundred, and authorities have largely blamed the deaths on religious extremists. There have also been attacks as far away as Beijing in the north and Kunming in China's southern Yunnan province. Last year, authorities in Xinjiang launched a tough year-long anti-terrorism campaign. Hundreds have been detained on suspicion of involvement in terrorist activities, according to state media and local government websites. Trials and death sentences have been quickly carried out. The government has offered generous rewards for anyone willing to provide information to authorities to help stop attacks. Several delegates at the meeting claim the public is playing a bigger role in helping to thwart attacks. Xinjiang's deputy Communist Party boss, Shohrat Zakir, says he believes there will be fewer terrorist plots this year. He says that many cases have been stopped while they were in the planning stages, but adds that there are some determined extremists who could still attack in advance. Even so, Zhang Chunxian shared figures during the meeting that he says highlight just how dangerous the region has become.
John
says that in 2013, there were 230 local government cadres who died on the job, which is far above the average for the rest of the country. He also says that when compared with other interior regions in China, there were 5.4 times more deaths among policemen in Xinjiang. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
A top Chinese official said Tuesday that the country will raise its retirement age to reduce pressure on pension funds. Yin Weimin, the Minister of Human Resources and Social Security, said Beijing will raise the retirement age. He said such changes will be phased in during the next 5 years. Yin warned China faces more pressure on its pension funds as the country ages. The number of Chinese over the age of 60 will rise to 39% of the population. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is Asia Business News on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Japanese share prices shook off a dismal performance on Wall Street the previous day to post gains Wednesday, helped by buying of construction firms and other shares on hopes of recovery in the domestic economy. The Nikkei share average rose 0.3% to close at 18,723. Hong Kong's main stock index, though, fell to its lowest level in nearly 2 months, weighed down by losses in overseas markets and weak economic data from China. Global investor sentiment was also dampened by worries about an earlier U.S. interest rate hike. The Hang Seng fell 0.8% to finish at 23,717. The China Enterprises Index also lost that 0.8%. It closed at 11,417. Russia's auto market is in free fall. As financial turmoil in the country makes cars more expensive by the day, demand for many brands has almost evaporated. Sales fell 38% in the year to February, with mid-market brands like Ford plummeting 78%, eating into earnings and threatening production. Only luxury cars are still holding up, as richer Russians count on them as status symbols, even if that means cutting back on other aspects of life. The Swiss pilots of a solar-powered airplane on a historic round-the-world journey said Wednesday they want the people of India to support their campaign for clean energy a day after the aircraft landed in that country. Bertrand Picard and Andre Borschberg spoke to reporters in the western Indian city of Ahmedabad after Picard flew the single-seat Swiss-made plane there from Oman on the second leg of their 35,000-kilometer journey. Picard said their goal was to spread the message of adopting clean technologies and improving the quality of life for India's 1.2 billion people. That's Asia Business News.
This is Today in History. On March 12, 1912, the Girl Scouts of America, then known as the Girl Guides, was formed in Savannah, Georgia, by Juliet Gordon Low. On this day in 1925, physician, revolutionary, and political leader Sun Yat-sen died. He is known as the father of modern China and was revered by both the communists and the nationalists. Sun helped overthrow the Qing dynasty and became the Republic of China's provisional president in 1912. He was one of the founders of the Kuomintang, the Chinese Nationalist Party. In 1930, Indian human rights leader Mahatma Gandhi led a demonstration known as the Salt March to protest the British monopoly on salt. It highlighted Gandhi's tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience. In 1933, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt began a series of 30 radio broadcasts to the American people that would become known as Fireside Chats. Mr. Roosevelt used the messages to explain his policies during the Depression and the Second World War. In 1938, German troops marched into neighboring Austria to annex the nation into the Third Reich. In 1947, President Harry Truman, in a speech to a joint session of the U.S. Congress, requested aid for Turkey and Greece. Greece was facing a communist insurgency, and Turkey was trying to resist Soviet pressure to share control of the Dardanelles Straits. The so-called Truman Doctrine was the first in a series of steps to try to contain Soviet influence.
And on March 12, 2003, reformist Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic was assassinated. He was responsible for handing former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic over to international war crimes authorities. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, the top U.S. diplomat urges U.S. lawmakers to grant the president more power to combat Islamic State militants. We'll have a report from the front lines of a Syrian village under Islamic State attack. And we'll hear from Nigeria's president about links between the Islamic State and Boko Haram. I'm Michael Lippin. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has urged the U.S. Senate to approve President Barack Obama's request for formal authorization to use force against the Islamic State group. Appearing before the Foreign Relations Committee on Wednesday, Kerry said such approval would show that Americans are united in wanting to defeat the militants and anyone associated with them. President Obama already has been using his legal powers to take action against Islamic State, but Kerry said congressional authorization would give the president more flexibility to direct a successful military campaign. Iraqi government forces and Shiite militia allies have entered the strategic town of Tikrit after a 10-day offensive to drive out Islamic State militants. On Wednesday, the coalition of anti-Islamic State forces moved into Tikrit's northern Qadisiyah district in an operation to outflank the militants who seized the city in June. Tikrit was one of the largest Iraqi cities overrun by the militants last year. French authorities are investigating whether two Islamic State militants, one of them a boy, featured in a new video, have connections to France. The video, released online this week, shows the older militant and the boy standing behind a 19-year-old Israeli Arab whom they accuse of being an Israeli spy. At the end of the video, the boy is shown shooting the Israeli Arab in the head at close range. The slain man's family has denied that he was spying for Israel and said he went to Syria to actually fight for the Islamic State group, but later had a change of heart and wanted to return home. A French official told the Associated Press on Wednesday that the two militants in the video are thought to be French citizens. Well, Islamic State militants have launched a major offensive on the region of Ras al Ain in northeastern Syria. VOA Kurdish Service reporter Zana Omer was in one village under attack on Tuesday and has been able to send in this report narrated by Robert Rafel.
Fighting is intensifying in and around Sarakanya as Kurdish YPG forces try to hold back Islamic State militants. The militants appear bent on regaining momentum after a series of territorial losses, among them Tal Tamer. Now the YPG faces hundreds of IS fighters who have laid their sights on the village of Tal Kanzer near the Turkish border. YPG fighters, backed by coalition airstrikes, were able to push the militants out of Kobani earlier this year, proving themselves among the strongest anti-IS combatants on the ground. Kurdish forces have attracted a handful of foreign fighters, Americans, British, and others, to their cause. In Tal Kanzer, these volunteers, like many of the YPG forces themselves, appear woefully under-equipped.
Yeah, well, I'm way off range.
Yeah, I know, bro, I know.
We need to get a map on you.
It's not clear how long they can hold out against the heavy weaponry of Islamic State fighters, who are also pressing in on the villages of Ahol, Tal Barak, Tal Hamas, and Tal Tamer. For Zana Omer and Tal Kanzir, Robert Rafel, VOA News.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says Boko Haram fighters are being trained at camps in the Middle East run by Islamic State militants. The president sat down for an interview with VOA reporter Chris Stein in Abuja on Wednesday, 4 days after Boko Haram's leader publicly pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Mr. Jonathan said his government has known that there are links between the two groups.
Some of the Boko Haram members go to have their training in the ISIS camps and come back. So the linkages are known, and it's not just now that we know by the linkages.
Well, Mr. Jonathan also predicted that an ongoing multinational offensive will oust Boko Haram from the territory it controls in northeastern Nigeria within the next 3 weeks. A member of the Russian Kremlin's Human Rights Council says there are reasons to believe the prime suspect in the killing of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov confessed under torture. Andrei Babushkin told reporters on Wednesday that he had seen numerous wounds on the body of the suspect, Zaro Dadaev, during a visit to his prison cell on Tuesday. Babushkin wrote on his website that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Dadaev and another suspect were tortured while in custody. Well, the United States will provide an additional $75 million in non-lethal equipment to Ukraine, including counter-mortar radar, drones, radios, and medical equipment. The Obama administration said Wednesday it will also impose sanctions on a handful of pro-Russian separatists and others blamed for the civil war that has torn apart Ukraine's eastern regions. The new U.S. aid does not include the weapons that Ukraine has sought and that many Obama administration officials and members of both parties in Congress have urged President Obama to provide. The political fallout continues over a letter sent on Monday to Iranian leaders by freshman Republican Senator Tom Cotton and 46 other Republican senators. The letter warned Tehran that any deal reached in the ongoing international talks to curb Iran's nuclear program would not last after President Obama leaves office. VOA's Cindy Sain reports from Capitol Hill.
At a Senate hearing Wednesday, Secretary Kerry called the letter irresponsible and said it breaks with 200 years of precedents conducting U.S. foreign policy.
No one is questioning anybody's right to dissent. But to write to the leaders in the middle of a negotiation, to write them and suggest that they're going to give a constitutional lesson, which, by the way, was absolutely incorrect, is quite stunning.
Kerry is leading the Iran nuclear negotiations, which resume next week in Switzerland. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker is co-sponsoring bipartisan legislation that would let Congress weigh in on the merits of a potential Iran nuclear deal. Corker did not sign the letter, but said he was disappointed by Kerry's comments that Congress cannot modify a deal.
You've gone back on your statement that any agreement must pass muster with Congress. The way we pass muster here as we vote.
Cindy Sain, VOA News on Capitol Hill.
And before we go, U.S. military officials say rescuers have found human remains in the search for an Army helicopter that crashed off the Florida coast with 11 soldiers on board. A spokesman at the Eglin Air Force Base in Florida said debris from the wrecked Black Hawk helicopter was discovered early Wednesday after it failed to return to base Tuesday night. The missing include 7 Marines and 4 members of the National Guard. Authorities say a dense fog advisory was in place for the region during the mission with reduced visibility. That's it for International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Business News on The Voice of America. U.S. stocks ended lower for a second straight session Wednesday as worries increased the Federal Reserve could bump up rates as soon as June, and the dollar strengthened further, dampened the outlook for U.S. corporate earnings. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 27 points, or about 0.15%, to close at 17,635. The S&P 500 also losing, down to 2040, and the NASDAQ composite dropped 9.85 points, or about 2%, 0.2% that is, to finish at 48.49. The U.S. government is taking the nation's biggest satellite TV provider to court, accusing DirecTV of misleading millions of consumers about the cost of its programming. The Federal Trade Commission said Wednesday that its complaint charges against DirecTV with deceptively advertising a discounted 12-month programming package. It says consumers were not clearly told the package requires a 2-year contract. The FTC said the advertising also did not make clear that the cost of the package would increase by up to $45 more per month in the second year, and that there was a hefty early cancellation fee up to $480. Wireless equipment maker Ericsson says it will be cutting 2,200 jobs in Sweden as part of a $1.1 billion savings package. That's 9 billion kroners if you're keeping track in Swedish currency. The Stockholm-based company said the layoffs would mostly affect research and development and supply positions. Ericsson is a leading maker of mobile broadband infrastructure. It said Wednesday the cuts were part of a savings plan announced back in November. And Ukraine expects to receive $5 billion in credit from the International Monetary Fund in the coming days, according to the country's finance minister, the first in a series of bailout loans. That's business news on VOA. Well, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is perhaps the most famous address in the world. Of course, it's the White House here in Washington. So perhaps people in Pennsylvania would know that address? Well, however, a man in western Pennsylvania, in prison, admitted mailing a threatening letter to President Barack Obama. He sent it to the wrong address. Joseph Savage mailed his letter to 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, the White House got it anyway, and he pled guilty.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. A huge garbage patch in the North Pacific Ocean traps debris from both hemispheres and is a major environmental threat to sea life. Michael Sullivan joins us from Honolulu, where researchers are tracking the trash that covers a huge swath of the Pacific.
The culprit is plastic, which finds its way into waterways and eventually the ocean. Scientists at the University of Hawaii head to sea in research vessels to monitor the effects of the trash on marine life. The trash concentrates in five of the Earth's ocean gyres, which are naturally occurring circular currents, says marine scientist Dave Carl.
As you get closer and closer to the center of that, the central axis of that feature, the waters become more quiescent. So they tend to trap floating debris.
The Pacific trash patch is famously as big as the U.S. state of Texas, but Carl says what is seen from passing ships is mostly empty ocean.
The impression that people, I think, got about this patch was that it was a solid mass of plastic. You could almost jump off your boat and walk across the state of Texas on this plastic footing. That's not the way it is at all.
He says the churning of the ocean quickly reduces much of the plastic to a chemical sludge. Alan Clark of Hawaii's East-West Center says it is dangerous in that form, since tiny plankton organisms consume the particles.
That are eaten by things like jellyfish, who turn out to be one of the favorite food of larger fish. And then you go through the food chain to tuna and things of this nature.
And the cycle is completed as people find the plastics on their beaches and chemicals in contaminated food. These scientists are tracking the impact of pollution in the North Pacific, but they say pollution is a problem in all of the Earth's oceans. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
The U.S. Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C. is recognized worldwide as one of the most enduring symbols of the U.S. government and American democracy. Now, since last November, the dome has been wrapped in metal scaffolding and fabric, all part of a long overdue renovation project. VOA's Jeff Custer is in the cafe with more on that.
The last time the U.S. Capitol Dome underwent a renovation was in 1960. Since then, the dome has become weathered and worn, and as the architect of the Capitol reports, has more than 1,000 cracks and other defects. The dome was first completed around 1863. Its cast iron frame, says U.S. Senate historian Don Ritchie, has contributed to that weathering.
The Capitol dome being cast iron has been hit by lightning countless times, and it's been weathering that position since 150 years, since 1863. And it has been leaking lately. And there's a lot of artwork inside, including the big canopy in the center. And so the current construction is to repair the leaks, to fill the cracks, to take off excess layers of paint, and to paint it again.
As the work to remove old paint and apply primer continues, a large section of the building is covered by plastic and a special pink fabric designed to reduce wind and protect workers from the elements. Much of the construction is done after dark to prevent the noise from disturbing lawmakers who continue to meet inside. Some visitors to the Capitol, hoping for a souvenir picture of the usually gleaming dome, have been let down by the current view.
It was dramatic. It's very fantastic. It's all white. But when I come here today, it's under construction, so my family can see it clearly.
The project is expected to take more than 2 years to totally complete. It is scheduled to be ready for the inauguration of a new president in February of 2017. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. It's available every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. You might know soprano Sarah Brightman from her smash duet with Andrea Bocelli, Time to Say Goodbye. Or you might recognize her as Christine from Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera. But now the 54-year-old singer hopes to perform where no other professional singer has before, in space. Brightman has been training in Star City near Moscow for a 10-day trip to the International Space Station later this year. She told a news conference that sometimes she struggles to believe she is actually making this trip.
And there are moments, though, when I come away from it and maybe have a little time where I'm allowed home, or I go somewhere for a weekend, and I think, my God, have I really done that? Is this really, really happening to me? But the training is hard. I mean, there's no denying that, and it's probably not for everybody. But I'm learning huge amounts just about myself doing it, what I'm capable of.
Sarah Brightman says that singing in space presents some very special challenges, including working in microgravity. And the way that your lungs, sinuses, and voice work is very different in space than it is on Earth. But Brightman said she has been working with her ex-husband, Lloyd Webber, to create a special song just for this trip.
So I'm trying to find the piece which is beautiful and simple in its message, as well as not too complicated to sing. I have been working a little with my ex-husband, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who's actually come up with the most beautiful line for something. So we're just taking it slowly at the moment. But I don't want to, obviously, because of the complexities of this, I don't want to promise too much.
Sarah Brightman would not say how much she paid to go on this trip, though news reports have said it is more than $52 million. The journey is being arranged by the private space company Space Adventures, and two other people will join Brightman on the trip. Sarah Brightman told reporters that she has talked to others who have sung in space, including former astronaut Chris Hadfield, who did his version of David Bowie's Space Oddity on the International Space Station. But Brightman says she doesn't want to promise too much because of the very different environment of space.
So I'm going to try and do something which is very simple, that doesn't put too much stress on me or the fellow cosmonauts up there, so that I can deliver something. And I think that everybody on Earth will, if they're interested and want to watch this, I think they'll understand if I can only get so far with it. Because in a way, it is an experiment. That's my experiment up there.
For the soprano, a trip to space has been something she has wanted to do since watching the first moon landing as a child. She predicted that liftoff and seeing Earth from space will be very emotional experiences for her.
I think the moments of, obviously, liftoff will be incredible. The moment really after insertion, when you're orbiting and you look out of... I've got a window on my right-hand side, and apparently when you first look out of it, and everybody who's... the commander who's taking me up, I think he's looking forward to seeing my face when I first... because apparently you have this like real mixed emotion of joy and sadness and all sorts of stuff that happen that you don't really have on Earth. It's an amazing, amazing emotion.
Sarah Brightman's flight on board a Soyuz rocket is planned to lift off on September 1st. Until then, she will continue her training outside Moscow. So have you ever dreamed of going to space? Are you a Sarah Brightman fan? Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Well, apparently a gentleman knew the address of a certain shoe store. He was an ex-con who had just finished a 15-year robbery sentence. He admitted to robbing the same New Jersey shoe store, and the same clerk happened to be behind the counter. Prosecutors say 41-year-old Christopher Miller robbed a Stride Right store in Toms River, New Jersey in March 2014, came back to rob it again, and, of course, he fled on foot. He was caught. Time for sports on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. The United States is experiencing a gradual decline in the number of golf courses in the country to correct an oversupply between the 1960s and early 2000s. That, according to a global report published Wednesday by the sports governing body. The study, entitled Golf Around the World, said there are 34,011 golf courses in the world, 45% of which are in the United States. The current total of 15,372 courses in the U.S. is down from a peak of over 16,000 following a gradual but steady market correction, according to the report. Although there are 153 projects in various stages of development, the number of new courses still being opened is at an all-time low. Golf, meanwhile, is swinging into action in South Africa at the Shawnee Open, which begins in Pretoria today. Mark Tompkins is there, where Ross Fisher sets out to defend his title.
The Shawnee Open visits the Pretoria Country Club for the first time as defending champion Ross Fisher looks to hold on to the title he won in Centurion last year.
Yeah, it's always nice to come back and defend the title. You know, it's only the fifth time I'll be doing it. So, yeah, just excited to be back in South Africa again playing and just looking forward to the week ahead.
Fisher ended a four-year wait for a win with a three-shot victory over Ireland's Michael Hoey and South African Danny van Tonder. The Englishman finished second in South Africa in the Nedbank Challenge in December. Another Fisher plays this week, having tasted success in East London last time out. Trevor Fisher Jr.'s fine performance earned him his first win on the European Tour, and he'll be keen for another good showing here. Also in the field is Andy Sullivan, who's bidding to become only the fourth player in history to win his opening three titles in the same country, having won the South African Open and the Joburg Open a fortnight ago. Another South African who'll feel at home this week is George Coetzee, who's been a member here since an early age, and he won the first event he ever played at 10 years old over nine holes on this course.
Mark Tompkins reporting. NASCAR has lifted its suspension of Kurt Busch and ruled the former champion can compete in the title chase should he qualify. Busch missed the first three races of the season when NASCAR suspended him over an alleged domestic assault on his former girlfriend. That's a look at sports on The Voice of America.
There has been a growing trend in recent years that rock and pop artists release albums with tunes from the so-called Great American Songbook. That's the music written and performed throughout much of the 20th century by artists such as Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra. No, that's not Frank Sinatra. It's actually Annie Lennox, the latest to join the ranks of rock singers turned standard artist. As lead singer of the Eurythmics, Lennox topped the charts in 1983 with Here Comes the Rain Again. Annie Lennox's latest solo album, Nostalgia, features a number of songs, such as Billie Holiday's big hit from 1939, God Bless the Child.
Hello, my man. And Papa may have, but God bless the child. It's God is all. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, 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 God. God bless the child.
Another pop singer dabbling in music of the past is Lady Gaga.
After one old quart of brandy, like a daisy I'm awake, with no bromo self-surrender, I don't even shake. Men are not a new sensation. I've done pretty well, I think, but this half-pint imitation put me on the brink. But I'm wild again, beguiled again, a simple whimpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered. Come on. I couldn't sleep and wouldn't sleep till all came and told me I shouldn't sleep. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered. And
Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered first heard in the Broadway production of Pal Joey in 1940. Other singers who've recorded songs from the Great American Songbook include former Beatle Paul McCartney, Queen Latifah, Rod Stewart, Harry Nilsson, and the list keeps growing. And after many hits earlier in his career, Nilsson turned to the oldies with It Had to Be You.
It had to be. I wandered around, finally found somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue.
That's music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Glad just to be sad, thinking of you. Some mothers I've seen, it had to be me.
Did you know that you could not own a ferret in New York City? That's true, and it will remain an illicit pleasure after health officials failed to overturn a decades-long ban on the furry mammals. The City Board of Health voted 3-2 with 5 abstentions in favor of lifting the ban, but 6 votes were required for passage, according to a spokeswoman for the City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We appreciate the board's concern for the health and safety of New Yorkers in their decision to keep in place the prohibition on ferret ownership in New York City, a city health department said in a statement. The board was considering repealing the prohibition on keeping ferrets in New York homes as long as they are vaccinated for rabies, according to the health department. New Yorkers in a recent poll were torn over allowing ferrets to join the ranks of pets, with 39% agreeing that they should be permitted, another 42% opposing the weasel-like creatures. Domesticated ferrets live an average of 6 to 8 years. They sleep much of the day and spend much of their waking hours building a reputation for being mischievous and playful. Other than New York City, having a ferret is also banned only in California or Hawaii, according to animal advocacy groups. The health department in New York says ferrets have informally been banned as pets since 1959, that according to the New York Times. Well, we're certainly glad that you included us in your daily plans and listened to VOA Global today. We invite you to come back tomorrow for another edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zubir Osman, and managing editor Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a wonderful day.